You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we talk with Wisconsin's new poet laureate about finding poetry that speaks to you. First, the Human Rights Campaign is an organization that advocates for civil rights for the LGBTQ community. And every year, they rank all 50 states on how well their laws do or don't protect LGBTQ individuals. The group recently released its fifth annual report, known as the State Equality Index. And our next guest says advocates in Wisconsin have won some basic protections, but there's still work to do. Catherine Oakley is State Legislative Director and Senior Counsel for Human Rights Campaign. Catherine, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
People may think now that the Supreme Court has legalized gay marriage that the LGBTQ fight is over. What are the areas of the law that advocates are still working to change?
Oh, many different things. Marriage equality has been a wonderful thing. We're very grateful for it, and truly it is only the beginning of working toward full LGBTQ equality in many states across the country, including in Wisconsin. You mentioned the State Equality Index, which we recently released, and we had four categories that states could fall into based on their laws and policies. Those four were working toward innovative equality, which was sort of the top category, then solidifying equality for states that had a lot of the protections that we assess. Below that is building equality, and that's where Wisconsin fell, just above high priority to achieve basic equality, where states had not only no non-discrimination protections, but also in some cases anti-LGBTQ laws on the books.
So looking at those four categories and you know, the spectrum that they represent in laws that are there to protect LGBTQ individuals, where does Wisconsin fit kind of number-wise in that scale?
So Wisconsin fits into this building equality, which there are two states that are in that section, and there are 28 states that are in that lowest rated category beneath. So Wisconsin's kind of in the middle, top middle of the pack, with certainly states that have done less, but also lots of states that have done more. So there's lots of room to improve for Wisconsin.
So what are some of the things that Wisconsin has put in place that puts them ahead of some other states?
Well, you know, one thing that Wisconsin does have are non-discrimination laws that in employment, housing, places of public accommodation, education, adoption, and foster care. And those are really important protections, but unfortunately, they're only extended to people who are on the basis of sexual orientation, so lesbian, gay, bisexual folks. They do not explicitly include gender identity. So that means that transgender folks do not have those protections. And so I think that is an absolutely glaring omission, that without that, you know, Wisconsin's just not going to be able to move up into those, into the categories of states that are really working on innovative things, because Wisconsin really has to nail down those explicit protections before it can get into that category.
Are there other issues on which Wisconsin would need to advance in order to make it into those other categories?
Yeah, you know, we look at all different kinds of laws. We look at parenting laws. I mentioned non-discrimination laws. We look at hate crimes and criminal justice laws. Religious refusal laws, those are bad ones, which happily Wisconsin does not have. We have laws that relate to youth, including bullying laws. That's an area that Wisconsin certainly has some place to grow. And then also health and safety laws, you know, ensuring that, for example, transgender people have adequate access to gender-affirming care, you know, medically necessary care that is just too often not available to transgender people. So lots of room to grow in all of these categories, but particularly in, as I said, non-discrimination laws, youth laws, and health and safety laws.
We're talking with Catherine Oakley right now. She's State Legislative Director and Senior Counsel for Human Rights Campaign. And we're talking about that group's State Equality Index. It's the fifth annual report that they've released. And it looks at legal protections in place in different states for LGBTQ residents. And Catherine, what kind of trends are you seeing? You do this report every year. You're looking at each state individually, but I'm guessing there are also national trends that become apparent as you're crunching the numbers. What are you seeing this year?
Yeah, there absolutely are national trends. And, you know, one of the things that actually was really exciting about this report is that we had more states move up into that top category, the working toward innovative equality category, than we've ever had states move before. So we are really seeing positive momentum at the state level, which I think is wonderful news. One example of state that we saw move forward last year, which was really great, was in New Hampshire. We saw, a non-discrimination law that had protected on the basis of sexual orientation in the same way that Wisconsin's law currently does. New Hampshire updated theirs to include gender identity last year, and actually already in 2019, New York did the same. They had some regulations in place, which they have now replaced with explicit state law extending those protections to the transgender community. So, you know, that's one of the great trends that we are seeing is that, you know, I think in the last several years, there's been a lot of focus on anti-LGBTQ legislation, which we have unfortunately continued to see introduced and in some cases passed around the country. But I think really the story of the SEI this year is focusing on how many states are continuing to improve, that there's a lot of momentum at the state level to move forward on matters of equality.
It seems that one of the reasons why you need to look at what is in place in different states is because there doesn't seem to be a comprehensive approach on the federal level that would, if it was in place, overrule whatever the states had. Tell us about any efforts to pass or to at least introduce federal equality legislation.
Yes, that is a fantastic point. So currently, there are no explicit comprehensive civil rights protections for LGBTQ people at the federal level. The civil rights protections that we have do not explicitly include protections on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. And unfortunately, what that means is that in 30 states that don't have these non-discrimination laws at the state level, LGBTQ people remain at risk of being fired, evicted, or denied services because of who they are. So for that reason, my organization and our allies are working on a really critical piece of civil rights legislation called the Equality Act, which is a historic bill that would provide those consistent and explicit non-discrimination protections for LGBTQ people across key areas of life. So those include employment, housing, credit, education, public spaces and services, federally funded programs, and jury service. And we're very excited about that bill's prospects with a much more pro-equality Congress. And we also have, I believe, 150 major employers who have signed on to our Business Coalition for the Equality Act. So that's really great news. We have lots of wonderful support.
What are the key elements of that that would change in states that do not have or don't have protections or actually have things that are detrimental to LGBTQ people?
Yeah, I mean, what it would mean is that for an LGBTQ person, when you cross state lines, you don't have to worry about your rights going away. Now, because when we look at the map, because these protections are not explicit at the federal level, in some cases, depending on circumstances, people will have causes of action at the federal level if they do experience discrimination on the basis of their sexual orientation, gender identity. But it's very fact-specific. And it is not necessarily consistent. So we really need to have those explicit protections in place to make sure that people know that those rights travel with them. You know, when they do cross state lines, if they cross into a state that doesn't have statewide protections, that the federal government will make sure that their civil rights are protected.
It seems like it's an even more complicated and complex landscape, because I know that there are municipalities that will put protections in place that are not in place at the state level. How do all those different layers of government and what they decide they want to put in place work together or work against each other?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you're absolutely right that we have seen major cities across the country, as well as medium and very small cities. I believe that the smallest city to have passed a non-discrimination ordinance has something like 300 or 400 residents. So we've seen this happen in cities across the country where, you know, the cities are looking to their state governments. Their state governments have not taken action on matters of equality, and so the cities take that matter into their own hands. or in states where there are some good laws or even great laws at the state level, that you see cities who are saying, well, you know, those values are our values, and we want to make sure that people see that we also don't tolerate discrimination where we are. And it's really interesting. I mentioned that we had a very large coalition of businesses who support the Equality Act. Well, the reason that we have businesses who support the Equality Act is, first of all, these businesses have their own non-discrimination policies for their employees, but they also know that equality is good for business. And that's something that cities have recognized as well, that if they have really solid non-discrimination protections on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity, that it's good for business. People look at that kind of thing as an indicator of whether or not that city is a place that they want to live and work. So we definitely have seen cities embrace non-discrimination protections. And as I said, we're continuing to see movement at the state level. So we're hopeful that that momentum at the state level will continue. We're working to make sure it continues. And we're also working to nail some of those protections down at the federal level as well.
Well, Catherine, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Catherine Oakley, State Legislative Director and Senior Counsel for Human Rights Campaign. That's an organization that advocates for LGBTQ civil rights. She was with us to talk about how Wisconsin's civil rights protections for the LGBTQ community stacks up in the group's annual State Equality Index. And you can see that report in its entirety by going to WPR.org/Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Chances are, if you had any literature classes in high school, you probably read some poetry and maybe even had to try your hand at writing some verse, too. For many people, that's the extent of their exposure to poetry, and it can seem more intimidating than maybe picking up a novel or a book of short stories. Peggy Rosga is a civil rights activist, poet, and professor emerita of English at UW-Waukesha. She was recently named Wisconsin's Poet Laureate. Peggy, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here, happy for the opportunity to talk about poetry.
Well, how did you first come to appreciate poetry?
I probably was read to as a child, poems and other things, but what stands out in my mind is my junior year in high school, I had a wonderful English teacher who had us memorize poems and recite them together as a class, so there was no feeling of being put on the spot. Everybody did it. Everybody helped everybody else out. And I still remember some of those poems today.
And when did you start writing your own poetry?
I can't remember a time when I didn't write, specifically poetry. I know I started to write seriously about 1990 with the intention of getting good enough to publish. When my children were very small, I used to try writing haiku because I could remember 17 syllables no matter who was sick or who was fighting. And the haiku probably were not very good, but it was a way of getting in practice.
And what do you think is the power of poetry as compared to other forms of creative writing?
Well, I think, first of all, the beauty and the sound effects of the language, I think it's sound effects that first interest children in poetry, Dr. Seuss and Shel Silverstein. And then so much of our language is cliched. We develop some stock answers that serve the purpose. Sounds good. What's up? That kind of thing. But language is powerful, and drawing on all the resources of language, the sound, the metaphor, the symbols, the rhythm, bring us to the beauty of language. And I think we hunger for beauty. We hunger for beauty visually. That's why we vacation in scenic spots. But also to bring that beauty into an appeal to hearing is important. But I think also that I describe my own poetry as practicing seeing. So much passes us by while we're on a rush to get to work or get to school or get dinner on the table. And the poet is one who slows down and looks carefully at those things and brings to us a vision of what we might miss, and not only on its literal level, but on its significance. So there's that double, sometimes triple layer of meaning in the insight that comes from looking at something closely. I also think that poetry offers us another way of knowing. Most of the time we learn about something by analyzing it, by breaking it into parts. But poetry works by bringing things together. That's the basis of metaphor. One thing is like another. My love is like a red, red rose. Helps us to see things differently. And in all those ways, it's powerful.
I'd love to have you share one of your poems with us, Peggy. Can you read Cake and Lemonade for Neighbors, please?
Yes, I'd like very much to do that. That's my poem in the Poetry Chapbook anthology we published as part of the 50th anniversary of Milwaukee's Fair Housing Marches. What we wanted to do is, I think what poetry does, that is help us to envision what isn't yet in existence. And so we were looking for, you know, what is the inclusive community that we'd like to see? So this is my take on that. Cake and Lemonade for Neighbors. Where I want to live, neighbors gather on front porches, watch their children play across multiple front yards, laugh in Spanish, Arabic, Burmese, English, talk about back in the day, share sweet and savory snacks, lend each other a cup of sugar or flour, borrow hedge trimmers, a shovel or rake, help with chores when need be, apologize when need be, offer a word of advice, not more. Strum guitars and pluck banjos, make a little noise sometimes bring out a kitchen chair so everyone finds a comfortable place to sit on the unscreened, wide or narrow porch, or on the stoop. Sometimes just enjoy all black, brown, white, golden quiet together.
That's Milwaukee native Peggy Rozga. She's a civil rights activist, poet, and professor emerita of English at UW-Waukesha. That was her poem, Cake and Lemonade for Neighbors. She's with us today to talk about her role as Wisconsin's newly named poet laureate. And Peggy, what is a poet laureate? What is your charge for these next 2 years?
Well, a poet laureate basically is the face of poetry in whatever area he or she represents. So I have become the face of poetry in Wisconsin. It's a great honor. It's a great thrill. It's a little scary. The Poet Laureate Commission asks that I give readings, presentations, workshops in various parts of the state, grow poetry and creativity in Wisconsin. The Poet Laureate Commission also asks the Poet Laureate to develop a project. And what I would like to do is, first of all, ask people, what is your favorite poem? Just get poetry into conversation. There's this feeling that poetry is removed. But I think all of us have a poem that we fell in love with at some point, an English class, a wedding, a special event. And so I want to bring those into the conversation. I have begun to ask the members of the Common Council in Milwaukee what their favorite poems are. And a couple of them have already replied. Some of them had trouble because they had so many favorites.
Wow.
And that was really great to see.
Well, we talked briefly earlier, Peggy, that poetry can have a reputation sometimes of being very highbrow and unapproachable. for those who haven't read much poetry outside of maybe an English class, maybe years ago, it might seem overwhelming to know where to start. If you want to start appreciating and enjoying poetry, do you have suggestions for how to find poets whose style and maybe topic area might suit someone?
Yes, well, I can suggest a couple of places. Previous poet laureate Kim Blazer had a poetry recitation project and put that online on a Wisconsin map, so you can click on a place and hear people who love poems recite a poem that they love. So that's a place to connect with poems that other people have found that enjoyable that they want to commit them to heart. That's available on the Wisconsin Poet Laureate website. I also am posting on the Poet Laureate Facebook page. Every Friday I post favorite lines and usually have a link to the whole poem. So that's another place you can go. The Wisconsin Fellowship of Poets produces a calendar each year, a poetry calendar. And again, largely accessible poems. A lot of them connect with Wisconsin. And those are available in bookshops or from the Wisconsin Fellowship of Poets. So those are places that you can access poems. Your public library is also a good place. Librarians are awesome. just ask a librarian for suggestions.
Well, Peggy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Milwaukee native Peggy Rozga was recently named Wisconsin's Poet Laureate. She joined us to talk about how poetry can be accessible to anyone. You can find upcoming events with Peggy at wisconsinpoetlaureate.org, and you can find links to the resources that Peggy mentioned at wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up, in the midst of Virginia's blackface scandal, we take a look at the history of blackface. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump intends to declare a national emergency while signing legislation to prevent another government shutdown. As NPR's David Wellna tells us, with an emergency decree, Trump could increase funding for a southern border wall.
GOP Senate Leader McConnell announced on the Senate floor he'd just spoken with President Trump.
He's indicated he's prepared to sign the bill. He will also be issuing a national emergency declaration at the same time. And I've indicated to him that I'm going to support the National Emergency Declaration.
But the top Democrat in Congress, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, says Republicans should be uneasy.
Because if the president can declare an emergency on something that he has created as an emergency, an illusion that he wants to convey, just think of what a president with different values can present to the American people.
Pelosi says there is no national emergency on the southwestern border. David Wellna, NPR News, Washington.
Amazon is scrapping plans to build one of its new headquarter locations in New York City and will not search for another. The project would have brought 25,000 jobs to the city, but Amazon says it's pulling out after politicians and others objected to the nearly $3 billion in tax incentives promised to the online retailer. New York City Councilman Jimmy Van Brommer calls Amazon anti-labor and anti-immigrant.
If we believe that as progressive Democrats, immigrants, all immigrants should be safe, then even if we stand to financially benefit from this deal, we should oppose it. That if we believe in the rights of working people to organize, even if you stand to financially benefit from the deal, you should oppose it.
The reversal is a serious blow to New York's governor and mayor, who had lobbied intensely for the project. Amazon had planned to spend more than $2 billion to build its new offices in the Long Island City area. Stocks finished mixed on Wall Street after news of a surprise drop in retail sales back in December. This is NPR.
Hey, it's 4:32. This is news from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Brady Carlson. Good afternoon. PFAS are chemicals found in household products that can be harmful to humans. There have been a number of Wisconsin groups and individuals looking for stronger protections against the chemicals. Phoebe Petrovic reports that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has unveiled its PFAS action plan.
The EPA will advance on several fronts, including listing two of the most common PFAS chemicals as hazardous substances and developing maximum levels for the chemicals in drinking water. But some in Wisconsin say it doesn't do enough.
It's extraordinarily disappointing.
Laura Ola is a leading activist for PFAS regulation. She says the EPA is only addressing two out of thousands of PFAS chemicals, and their process is too slow.
The EPA's basically kicked the can down the road, and they're not going to be addressing it appropriately.
But Wisconsin is taking its own action. Ola and others have pushed the Departments of Natural Resources and Health Services to set groundwater quality standards for PFAS. That's expected mid-2019. Ola says that on the state level, things are moving in the right direction. Phoebe Petrovic, Wisconsin Public Radio.
State Supreme Court candidate Brian Hagedorn is defending his affiliation with a Christian school that bans gay teachers and students. Hagedorn sits on the board of Augustine Academy in Delafield. The school's code of conduct bars faculty, parents, and students from participating in same-sex relationships. Joanna Bielman-Doolin is the research director for One Wisconsin Now, a liberal advocacy group. She says Hagedorn's affiliation with the school calls into question his ability to be unbiased on the bench.
With viewpoints such as these, and more problematically, actions upon those viewpoints while he is a judge, while he is campaigning to be a state Supreme Court justice, it is simply disqualifying.
Hagedorn's campaign says the judge, quote, treats everyone fairly under the law, and that, quote, his job is to say what the law is and not what he thinks the law should be. The principal of a suburban Milwaukee high school says there will be consequences for students at a basketball game who displayed pictures of an opponent make it appear he was wearing blackface. The player was Nicolet High School star Jalen Johnson, who is black and is considered one of the top college prospects in the 2020 class. In a tweet, Johnson called Wednesday's display, quote, unacceptable. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports Port Washington High School principal Eric Burke apologized for the student's actions and said they would offer a, quote, sincere apology. And he says the school would, quote, make this right. This is WPR News.
On Point. To the best of our knowledge, Zorba Pastor on Your Health. These programs and many more are possible thanks to listener support. You can learn about WPR programs, schedules, and so much more at WPR.org. Thank you. Support also comes from the Orpheum Theater, presenting Love It or Leave It, a live performance of the political comedy podcast hosted by John Lovett, co-host of Pod Save America, March 2nd. Tickets are at madisonorpheum.com.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on the morning show, Wisconsin's maple syrup season is so close you can almost taste it. Kate Archer-Kent and her guest round up the best recipes that showcase the syrup, and they'll talk about the process of tapping trees. That's Wisconsin Weekend on the morning show tomorrow starting at 6. Now, Virginia Governor Ralph Northam is rejecting calls to resign after a decades-old photo surfaced of a person wearing blackface and another in a Ku Klux Klan hood. The image appears on a page dedicated to Northam in a 1984 yearbook. He denies being in the photo, but said he wore blackface another time that year while dressing up as Michael Jackson. Since then, Virginia's attorney general admitted to wearing blackface at a 1980 college party. In addition, Florida's secretary of state resigned after photos of him in blackface were publicly revealed. And a host of celebrities have recently gotten into trouble over blackface from years ago. So how did blackface come about, and why is it considered so offensive? Dwandalyn Reese is the curator of music and performing arts at the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Dwandalyn, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first off, what was your reaction as photo after photo of different people, high-profile politicians and others in blackface coming to light?
I think my reaction these days is just disappointment and sadness.
And was it any surprise to you that so many people have this somewhere in their past?
It really isn't, and that's probably because I've been studying this and I understand the pervasiveness of this practice, this performance practice.
So when asked by CBS News about whether he would resign, this is what Governor Northam had to say.
Right now, Virginia needs someone that can heal. Virginia also needs someone who is strong, who has empathy, who has courage, and who has a moral compass. And that's why I'm not going anywhere.
Dwandalyn, do you have any thoughts about his decision so far to stay in office?
No, I don't, actually. And I think it's an interesting situation that the state of Virginia is going to have to work out and the people of Virginia about where Governor Northam really goes from here. I'm not going in a position to second judge, but it does provide a difficult circumstance for people to kind of deal with this admission and to deal with this knowledge and how that state, which I'm a resident of, how people choose to move forward.
And let's define blackface. I think people have probably seen at least some of the pictures, the images that we're talking about. But in general, when we talk about blackface and performing in blackface, what are we talking about?
Well, what is most important is to really understand the history of how this came about. It started in the 1830s with white actors blacking out their face with cork or grease or whatever they had at their disposal to create caricatures on stage of African Americans. And these caricatures would use language, speech patterns, music, and dance to really make fun of African Americans and in grotesque depictions of African American values and traditions, and really lampoon them as something lesser than the white audiences that were enjoying these performances.
So for something to compare it to in the early days of theater, for instance, in Shakespeare's times, women were not allowed on stage, and men often played a woman's role dressed as a woman for these plays that had, you know, both men and women in the cast as characters. But this is very different, isn't it?
It's very different. It's meant to dehumanize African Americans, which is already a situation that they've been placed in due to being enslaved in this country, but it's a mechanism to separate them from whites in a way that not only objectifies them but sees them as less than perfect than their white counterparts. And so it's a painful exercise in how people are treated or believed, and its pervasiveness and how it's spread throughout the country and was really the first form of popular entertainment, really spread these caricatures across the country in a way that it came to define who African Americans were in many people's minds and opinions.
You just touched on something that I wanted to make sure we talked about, because it was something that I learned in preparing to speak with you today. This was an incredibly common form of quote-unquote entertainment for a long time. I did not realize how big a part of American entertainment culture this really was.
Yeah, it was really embedded in the culture and the performance tradition, so much that it carried on into the 20th century and even into the 21st century. It was not only the blacking up, but it was the jokes that were told. It was in the performance of the straight man and the jokester, and really a whole stage performance that really defined minstrelsy along with the blacking up element.
We are talking about the many high-profile public figures who are finding themselves having to answer for wearing blackface in the past and in the not-too-distant past. We're talking with Dwandalyn Reese. She's the curator of music and performing arts at the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. And I also found it really interesting that this was actually a form, again, in large quotation marks, of entertainment that took place in the North. And for a lot of Northerners, they did not have personal experiences of interacting with African Americans.
They did not, certainly not the same kind of experiences that those in the South did. And in so many ways, it is a way of cultivating views of difference and also romanticizing their own imagery of who African Americans are, really depriving them of who they are as individuals and lumping them into one group or stereotype, which most of these characters really turned into. And these are the same stereotypes that you hear when people talk about portrayals of African Americans on film and on television. even on radio and in recordings.
Right. It seems like even if it was not a white person blacking their face to do this very exaggerated, very caricatured presentation of an African-American, that when there were actually African-Americans then in entertainment, in desegregated entertainment, they were often forced into a very similar role.
Well, you look at it in several ways. In one way, this was expected of audiences, and those performers who had aspirations to make a living in show business had to give the audiences what they wanted. So if the expectation was blackface, many African Americans donned the blackface to participate in professional careers. But they also did something very interesting. They were kind of mimicking whites, mimicking them. So there is a way of kind of taking the tools of people who are dehumanizing them and trying to signify, as we would say, trying to comment on what that actual act really means from an African-American perspective.
Are you able to give us some examples of those caricatured characters, and maybe then if you are able to, the examples, like you just said, about African-Americans kind of turning it around on the white performers?
Well, a good classic one, and you had mentioned Shakespeare in Women, is the mammy figure. Quite often, not only caricaturing African-Americans in general and men, but many people portrayed women in that way. And so there's a whole nother history about the dehumanization of women and African-American women. And that mammy figure, if you look throughout the history of film and television, appears in so many guises. She's a smart-mouthed woman, or she's also very wise and very grounded. And so you'll see that figure appear in much of the storytelling, that the visual storytelling that we have. Another character is the Jezebel, who is fast and hypersexualized and becomes a type, a stereotype that you will see, particularly in the older films of the early films of the 20th century. It becomes a type that really, even though it evolves throughout the decades, it becomes one of the limited images that African-American women can be perceived in. The dandy, the real slick character who can talk himself out of trouble or is a con man. Once again, you think about the films and television characters and where their roles for African-Americans. So you can see how many of these caricatures, which become stereotypes and embedded in the popular perception of who African-Americans are, really spread not only throughout the country, but over the decades and over the past century and a half.
We're talking about the history of blackface with Dwandalyn Reese. She's the curator of music and performing arts at the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to all of these instances of blackface coming to the surface? Should Virginia Governor Ralph Northam resign over his blackface scandal? Should any politician who's in the same position? What questions do you have about the history and the impact of blackface? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. You can also tweet us at CentralTimeWPR. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're talking about the history of blackface with Dwandalyn Reese. She's the curator of music and performing arts at the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the unearthing of all of these photos of white people wearing blackface? Are there any cases in which blackface is okay, or is it always offensive? If you're a person of color, how are you affected by these many instances of blackface worn by public figures and others? What questions do you have about how this tradition came to be? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. And Dwendolyn, there was a recent poll by the Pew Research Organization came out this week. It shows that 34% of Americans say blackface is, quote, always or sometimes okay as part of a Halloween costume. What does that say to you about the understanding of what blackface means?
It sounds like people don't understand the significance of blackface and how it resonates with African Americans. And part of that understanding is an empathy about the history and really delving into the history and see what the intention of the act was and how it impacted people on a long-term basis. And, you know, to frame it as a Halloween costume as something fun really takes away from its intention and impact in shaping how African Americans have been viewed and treated in society.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Elizabeth in Madison is up. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I have watched with my daughter a movie called Holiday Inn. It's a very old movie with Bing Crosby and another white female actress. And it was appalling to me the first time seeing this movie where they did an ode to President Lincoln and how he freed the slaves, apparently. And everybody in the band put on blackface. Bing Crosby put on blackface, along with emphasizing lips and doing things with their hair. It was horrific, but I have used it as a teaching tool for my daughter of things that are not acceptable, and it really has resonated with her. She's now 20, almost 21 years old, and it actually was an amazing teaching tool, a sad commentary on how people thought that was acceptable, especially there were African Americans in the film. I just can't even fathom that would be acceptable. It's hard for me to wrap my brain around that.
Thank you so much for that call, Elizabeth. And Dwendolyn, that brings up a really interesting point because there are so many things in older movies or even television shows today are recognized as very offensive, whether it's to people of color, whether it's to women. What lens should we be looking at those past works through, or should we be putting them on the shelf?
That's an interesting question, and it's a complicated question. You look at these films and TV shows for their entertainment value, but you also have to bring a critical lens. I think it's more than just saying it's a product of the times, but you have to understand the social and cultural and historical context in which these images are circulating, and also the complication that in many of these performances, there were African Americans sitting alongside these performances and having to be subject to them and putting yourself in someone else's shoes. How much that must have felt to have to take that on and participate it in a way. It's, you know, you can't erase history. What exists, it exists. But you can give a critical lens to it and how you choose to interpret and absorb what's being presented to you.
Let's go back to the phones, and Kurt in Appleton is up. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you have to share?
Yeah, I was listening to your program and wanted to call in. And it's just really interesting, and your speaker is doing a great job of you talking about this is not as cut and dry kind of pieces. I relate to the person taking the screen was when I was in Madison in the 80s, UW-Madison, there was a fraternity group that dressed in blackface on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, which was the campus really got upset. And, you know, they were reprimanded and all those things. So that was never okay. But, you know, earlier that year, people would be dressing up as Michael Jackson because, you know, Thriller was popular. So, you know, that was 40 years ago, 35 years ago. I guess where do you draw that distinction between where it was intentionally malicious or it was just, you know, I suppose a sign of the times, or just, you know, maybe ignorance is actually the better way to put it, not defense.
Thanks for that call. I want to make sure Dwendolyn has a chance to respond to that. So, Dwendolyn, that is an interesting question, because I think one of the responses to all of these situations that have come up is that, well, it depends. Are you doing it as kind of an homage to someone, or are you ridiculing someone? And I believe that the Florida public official who had to leave his position had dressed up as a Hurricane Katrina survivor, not at all a kind representation. Is there any difference? Is it ever okay to portray someone of another race?
You know, it's a question of that portrayal, which is also pointing to the roles of the history of what blackface has always meant and the power dynamics. You know, white people had the power. They had the power to appropriate someone's image and perpetuate it across the country. And so I think it's very difficult to separate blackface from that history and from its impact and influence. I mean, obviously, dressing up in blackface on Martin Luther King Day is an affront, and it's obviously making a statement. It is not an affirmative statement about African Americans in this society, and it's meant to offend. But then you think again, if you're imitating Michael Jackson, why do you have to blacken up your face? What is the subtext that people are really not getting? You can imitate Michael Jackson without blacking up your face. So why is it that people seem to look at that as kind of an innocent sense of appropriating someone's image more so than it would have meant historically in another circumstance? I think if you start to not separate the history of this practice and how it has impacted and how it has shaped the lens of race and the treatment of African Americans, you come to realize that there's not a point where it's okay. I think we're trying to get to a point where this is not tolerable, that it affects and impacts a segment of our society in a profoundly negative way and is a hurtful and painful reminder of the place that African Americans have been put in this country throughout history.
A caller who we don't have time to take on the air said that it's a different context today than it was before. He has an antique collection of black memorabilia. He's white, but he and his black friends are able to laugh about it. He's wondering why it's not okay for him to laugh if his black friends are. What would you say to that?
I mean, part of the laughter is the absurdity of it. I mean, you turn it on its head and you look at the irony. It is absurd, but it's also very real. And I can't overstate how much the lack of empathy and understanding black pain and how this has really shaped an image. So many people, as a means of coping, try to make fun of the things that give offense. So you have to think about that in the grand scheme of things. And if you're coming at it with an empathy and an attitude that you can see this for the absurd, but still understand that it's painful for a lot of people and it has tremendous power in how it has shaped our values over time.
And very briefly, Dwendolyn, as we run out of time, it must be difficult to see these images come out, but is it good that it's getting all this attention, and does it maybe represent a turning point for the U.S.?
Well, that remains to be seen if it's a turning point or not, but I think that we're having a dialogue, and I've done many interviews over the last week, is a good thing. It's elevating the profile of the significance of this performance tradition and the impact of this performance tradition and how it has shaped our attitudes about race and African Americans in society.
And we'll have to leave it there. Dwendolyn Reese is the curator of music and performing arts at Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture. She joined us to talk about the history of blackface and the many instances recently of public figures having images from their pasts wearing blackface come to light. You can keep the conversation going on Twitter at Central Time WPR.